I'm listening to the show every morning, and you can say it's grand. It's not grand if you're not on it, though.
OTB's Mount Rushmore.
Some talent in Cork, isn't there? Wow. A few of the GAA boys weren't happy, but it was my sporting hero. I was contesting, I think, against Jimmy Barry Murphy. So once you're in that company, everything is good.
Join the debate across all our social channels at Off the Ball.
It's very, very special. Believe me, I think it becomes more special when you're on the couch, because it's something, unfortunately, inside me that's ultra competitive, and I need to be there.
Catch the live decision-making over the next few months on OTB AM on the OTB Podcast Network. The OTB Podcast Network.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
The Saturday panel on Off the Ball.
You are very welcome back to Off the Ball Saturday on News Talk. John Duggan with you through to 5 o'clock. You can text us on 53106. You can tweet us at Off the Ball. We're streaming live now as well, so you can watch us on the Off the Ball social channels, on Periscope for Twitter, at Off the Ball, on YouTube, on Facebook. You can also listen to us on the Go Loud app. Now, around this time of year, on a Saturday, we'd be sitting down or maybe travelling to watch a Heineken European Cup rugby final. Not possible, of course, due to the pandemic, but we're delighted to be joined over the next hour by two Irish heroes. Alan Quinlan, a winner with Munster in 2006 and 2008, and Mike Ross, a winner with Leinster in 2011 and 2012. Both Irish internationals, both rugby legends. Gents, how are we getting on?
Very good,
John. Not too bad.
Good, great to have you with us this afternoon, lads. The European Cup final, for me, I'm just thinking of how much of a game changer this competition has been over the last two decades. You have all the journeys of supporters from cities, from towns, from communities. You've got the finals, as Neil was speaking in the news round, people booking their tickets a year in advance. To me, guys, this has been a tournament that's been a great success, and hopefully we'll have a final in October. But I think the Irish people as well have really embraced it. Why do Irish people love the European Cup final so much, do we think?
You want to take that, Mike, or me?
I know, it's like, it's a bit of... Well, it's an excuse to get away for one thing, and there's some pretty good venues, but also Irish teams have been successful in it, and previously they hadn't been before. I mean, if you look at Munster or the Trailblazers, well, Ulster won it first in 99, and then Munster or the Trailblazers through the early 2000s, up in 2006, 2008, and then Leinster took it up. So, you know, there's a bit of romance about it. I mean, you hear about people traveling on the back of a Honda 50 from Cork down to Toulouse. Yeah, and it just kind of got its own momentum, I guess.
Did you travel on the back of a Honda 50 to Cardiff in 02 or Twickenham in 2000, Mike, before it all began for you?
No, I actually went to 2002. A Honda 50 wouldn't carry me. In 2002, I went over to watch Munster play Leicester in that final. And I remember I was playing for UCC at the time, and I didn't have a ticket. I went over without a ticket, and I actually swapped the UCC jersey for a ticket because the guy was a UCC fan who had the ticket and he wanted that jersey. So there's a little story for you.
Did he have a ticket himself? Did he give you his ticket? He didn't go?
No, I think he had a spare ticket.
Yeah, yeah. That's gas.
Yeah.
That is gas.
Yeah.
And Alan, can you match that story? Were you travelling on Honda 50s to any matches before you went to Twickenham?
No, I wasn't. I was lucky enough to be pretty much involved, John, from the start with Munster. I think when I remember the first European game at Thorn Park, Munster against Swansea, I think it was 95, 96, and I just thought this whole tournament was really unique, and it was exciting because you're playing against so many different players from right across the couple of continents, and it was just phenomenal, I think, and I was excited because I was starting out with Munster and I wanted to play in Europe. And I've always said this, you know, European week is always a different week. And that's the way it was for us, I think. And we initially, when we started off in the competition, it was more out of excitement and not a lot of expectation or pressure on us. Obviously, if a big English team or a big French team came to Thomond Park, it was we still had a huge amount of pride and trying to get the result there, but we didn't really believe in ourselves that we could go and win in Europe. I think the journey the fans had was, you know, you asked that at the start to Mike, like there's some incredible stories of people, how they traveled to France England, all over the place, Scotland, different matches we've had all over Europe. It's just been phenomenal. But for us as players, I look back in the European Cup now and I think how lucky we were to play in these big games. And there's a couple of moments and games kind of stand out. Like, we played Saracens in October in 1999 over in Vicarage Road, and we left, I think we left on a Thursday. We stayed on Thursday night, Friday night. The game was Sunday. We went to see Watford, Sunderland and Vicarage Road on the Saturday, which was a great buzz for us. So we were on this kind of journey, an incredible jolly, if you like. But we were pretty serious and we wanted to win. We knew we were playing a star-studded Saracens team on the Sunday. But it was a sensational game because we were so far behind at one stage. And then we won it with a late Jeremy Staunton try and we shocked Saracens. But we probably only had 30 or 40 supporters with us. I don't think anyone believed us. It wasn't on TV. Len Dineen was on Limerick Live 95 doing the game, and I think people were just shocked that we had gone to Saracens and won. And that was kind of the start of that journey for us. Most of the supporters that were there were our parents, and it just kind of kicked off then with us getting to the final against Northampton in 2000, the semi-final against Toulouse and Bordeaux and stuff like that. And I always remember Frankie Sheehan saying this, that the supporters were having the time of their lives. And I remember him referencing at one stage saying, Jesus, I'd love to be in the crowd, or I'd love to be in the post-match party or whatever with the fans and stuff like that. That they just had the time of their lives, really. And in fairness, people started to save up and put money aside to go to these games, and they had the most incredible weekends of all. And we had a wonderful journey as well, getting to probably from 1999-2000 onwards, you know, getting to quarterfinals, semifinals, finals, and lots of ups and downs along the way. But it was brilliant, and it's just such a fantastic competition. It always has been.
I'd say, Michael, it's hard to believe in a way that you were one of those fans in 2002, and then 9 years later, you're lining out for a Leinster team in a European Cup final.
Yeah, it was a bit of a weird journey back to Millennium Stadium again. And like, as Quinny referenced, I mean, I watched Munster perform heroics going up, and I think Leinster had won it in 2009, but, you know, they wanted to put their mark on the competition and become a great team in it. And so, like, I was lucky enough to play in two Heineken Cup finals and two wins from those against Ulster and Northampton. And, the competition just has a life of its own. And I think people will try and almost outdo each other in what they did to get to a game.
Rituals, superstitions, the day itself, nerves. What stood out from the days itself of big finals, lads?
I think for me, the adrenaline rush. I just love the excitement and the buzz of. I had to change the earphones, John. I'm getting a bit of sound back in my ear.
Well, Mike's a big tech man, so he can help you out.
I'm still having it, so I'm going to go back to the original ear.
It's all right. Mike, ritual on the day, say 2011, your first European Cup final. Was there anything that stood out? Did somebody give you an item? Did you speak to somebody that like gave you a really good message on the day? Or did you just treat it like any other game?
You try and treat it like any other game, even though it's not, you know. I remember just being acutely nervous that morning, you know, because obviously it was a big challenge with the likes of Tonga, Huia, Majati in the scrum to contend with. But, like, I suppose it was just, you almost wanted the game to be over and you have won and just, you know, just get there. But, as far as routine goes, you just try and follow the routine that you've always followed. You try not to change anything. Try and treat it as another game. Don't do anything different. Prepare as you've always prepared, and you know that's what we always were taught, so that's what I stuck to.
53106. We got a text in here from Neil and Greystones. Leinster comeback in 2011 Heineken Cup final was incredible to experience. Was there with three of my teenage kids getting an air coach at 5 a.m. from Greystones. We'll never forget the noise from Leinster fans. The roof closed the Millennium Stadium. Sean O'Brien like a runaway train smashing Northampton players. Johnny sensational, of course. Johnny Sexton scored 28 points that day. I would love to know how Mike turned the scrum around in the second half. How did you do it, Mike?
Well, with a little help from Greg Feek. I've been watching Northampton all season and watching them destroying scrums. And I kind of targeted, I decided that Tonga Wea was a key man, because when he started going forward, they followed after him. Northampton had a kind of a nice little arrow formation where they'd break the hooker's bind and disrupt the whole scrum and go through the middle of it. So in the first half, I was probably overextending myself by trying to go on after Tonga Wea. And, you know, we had a few looks at different camera angles at halftime, and I just stuck together more. So I got a bit more closer to Rickard Strauss and, you know, stuck to the plan, and then it worked.
There's this story about Johnny Sexton at halftime talking about Liverpool's comeback in the Champions League. Did that happen?
Johnny was ranting away in the background, but I was in the corner with the forwards looking at scrum footage, so it didn't really affect me, you know, and I wouldn't be a big soccer head anyway, so probably some of his references would have passed me by.
Alan, dressing rooms 2000-2002, did you feel by 06 and 08 that you were more experienced and that you were more able to deal with pressure?
Yeah, I think so, John. I think we had more belief in ourselves. I think 2000 was probably we were in bonus territory, particularly after beating Toulouse in that semi-final, and then going to Twickenham, and we were playing a bruised and battered Northampton side who were top of the Premiership. They had some brilliant players. But we were favourites going into that match, which was unbelievable, given the injuries that Northampton had. But did we really believe that we were good enough to win a European Cup? Probably not. I think 0-1 was the semi-final in Lille, where John O'Neill scores a try in the corner. It's not given. We were beaten by Stade. And then we're back in another final in 2002, playing against an incredible Leicester side, who had so many top-class internationals, British and Irish lines. We were definitely more resilient and stronger and more belief, but we still, I think there was a seed of doubt that we felt if we got everything right in the day and we stopped them from playing and got in their faces, we had a chance. But realistically, they were a brilliant side and we were probably beaten by a better side on the day. Looking back in the match, we certainly made a few mistakes and coughed up two soft tries. We did so much stuff right, particularly up front, because they had Johnson, Garford, Roundtree, Curry, Ben Kay, all these guys, seasoned internationals, and they dominated Europe that year with their forward pack. And we felt if we stopped them up front, we had a good chance. And we did that for most of the game, and we're beaten 15-9. But there was an acknowledgement and probably amongst the players when we sat down and reviewed the season and were honest with ourselves that we needed to get fitter, stronger, better, maybe recruit more players. And that started to, you know, that ambition was brilliant. It was there. So
yeah,
kept knocking on the door and you know, we got back to the final in 2006. Your question at the start was, did we feel we could do it in 06? So much. We felt so much better. We felt we were stronger and mentally tougher as well. And we had those experiences, which were very difficult, obviously, the experiences and the disappointments of losing finals and semi-finals along the way, because, you know, we're 5 or 6 years of this now, and losing sometimes can become a habit as well. So I really remember halftime. You asked Mike about the halftime of the Leinster dressing room, which was that incredible comeback in 2011. But I remember halftime in our dressing room against Biarritz, who had a star-studded side, a massive budget as well, and some incredible players. You could just feel that nobody was going to beat us that day, that there was just such a level of determination and attitude, and we were incredibly fit. We probably weren't the most skillful team in Europe. They probably had more skillful players, more expansive game, all that stuff, but we were now battle-hardened. We just were confident that if we just kept the pace up, the aggression, the energy, that we could do it. And it happened in the end. And I came off the bench for 4 minutes at the end. I got injured in round one, and I made a really good recovery to come back towards the latter stage of the season. And luckily, I got back involved in the squad about 2 or 3 weeks before that final, and got my place on the bench. I was the happiest sub in history, coming on for 4 minutes. Never touched the ball, didn't make a tackle, just ran around. And I jumped about as if I'd won it on my own, really. But it was it was just sensational, really. And you could see the joy and the joy and the support of the players, first and foremost, but then what it meant to people who kind of come on that journey from really from Bordeaux in 2000 and Twickenham, the way it built and the supporters started to really get behind the team and love the European Cup and love the journey. And it was just incredible after all the disappointments to win it in 06. So, yeah, we were mentally much stronger. We were a better team as well. I think we were fitter and stronger and more skillful and with some brilliant players who went on to become and were regular season internationals themselves. So we were in a much better place at that stage.
Sounds like Adam might paraphrase Conor Hoolan and say that he missed Munster's European odyssey because he was playing for Munster at the time. That is from Dave. Lads, best memory of the Heineken Cup, firing the pyrotechnics when Munster lifted the cup, looking up and seeing O'Connell Street on the screen and very unprofessionally jumping to my feet, cheering them on and then having to explain the significance to the English crew. That is from a texter in County Longford. The fulfilment and during games, guys, when say the Leicester game is going against you, Quinny, and then when the game in Northampton game is going for you, Mike, can you feel during a match that is turning either against you or for you? Like, for example, in that second half, it just seemed that everything opened up for you, Mike, against Northampton, and then it felt, even though you were still behind, you were going to win.
Yeah, well, I suppose the one message I remember taking out from halftime, besides the scrums, was Joe Schmidt roaring, "Hold on to the ball." Because we hadn't done that in the first half. We kind of forced it if a couple of passes hadn't gone to hand. And, you know, like every team will have their purple patch. And Northampton spent the first 40 minutes having theirs, and we felt it was our turn to have ours. And, you know, luckily, you know, Johnny got over for a couple of tries. Nathan Hines had a nice pick and go. And the things that they're breaking us in the scrum in the first half, and that didn't happen in the second half. And we just held on to the ball and just kept going at them. And eventually they gave.
And Quinny, did you feel that the matches were turning for you, against you? I remember Toulouse in the game you were man of the match of. In 08, they drew level. Do you feel during a match that it's going your way or not?
Yeah, I think usually, John, and it's very small moments in rugby. In all sport, probably. And you do feel it out in the field as players. I think if you're a supporter at a match, you feel if certain bounce of the ball goes your way, refereeing decision, all that kind of stuff. Go back to that Leicester game in 02. We lost the line-out that resulted in a try. And I remember running back under the post thinking, it's a massive moment against such a powerful team that we've gone out to try and frustrate and stop them getting momentum. And I really felt that affected us. And we played probably within ourselves. There's always games where you feel like, missed tackle, a bounce of a ball into touch. So many times I got up off rucks, John, when Rod was just spiralling the ball down the field and it was dribbling into touch, where a fullback is or a winger is coming back to try and get it, and they think it's going to sit up, and then it just dribbles into touch 5 yards out. They're massive psychological moments in a game that you sometimes feel when you're running down the field to that line-out, that this bit of momentum or this bit of these couple of breaks are going your way. So you do feel it. I think the more resilient you become, the more preparation you put into it, I think you're in, and the more experience you have when you're out on the field. And I think Mike said it there about the purple patch. That's something that you learn from experience, that the opposition will have their moments in the game. And people always talk about a great try or a great goal or a great point in hurling or whatever. But sometimes what wins the sporting matches is when you're hanging on for dear life near the line and you're defending and you stop the opposition from making a line break or getting that score or making that pass, because that can deflate the opposition. So it's a real psychological warfare as well, as physical warfare, rugby. And sometimes you get a moment where you defend for 10 minutes and the opposition don't score, and you do feel it as a player that we have them. We're in their heads. We're breaking them down. And they're the parts of the game that I loved in the latter parts of my career, because it's the psychological battle as well as the physical battle. And, you know, Mike said it there. Northampton had all their moments, great moments in the first half where a simple message, like people mightn't understand how important that message is. It sounds very simplistic. Hold on to the ball. It's something you tell an under 8 or an under 10s team, hold on to the ball. But it means more than hold on to. It means break them mentally. Don't let them, don't make mistakes. Do the simple things well. Run hard with the ball. Don't force the pass. Build phases. And then you'll find little chinks in the armour. So Leinster just went out and did the simple things well. And probably some of the success and big matches we won over the years was down to doing the simple things really well. The set piece, holding on to the ball. And it was two varying styles from our wins in 06 and 08. Because in 06, we were still very much a direct team. We had Trevor Alstead at 12. Rog kicked a lot. We came around the corner with the forwards making hard carries. Our game plan wasn't that hard to figure out. It was just you had to roll up your sleeves and physically match the kind of intensity that we were trying to bring. 08 was different. We had Dougie Howlett, Maffey, Tupoki, so much attacking flair to our game as well. So there is moments in games where you always feel you're either losing it or winning it. And the ones where you think you're losing it, sometimes it needs someone like a Johnny Sexton or a Paul O'Connell or a Ronan O'Gara to say, forget about what's just happened. Let's dust ourselves down and do the next thing pretty simply. And that comes with experience as well, you know.
Mike, how did you celebrate in 11? Can you remember what happened after the match?
I remember after the match when the final whistle went, you know, just pure joy. And I think, you know, Quinny would have experienced that. And that's the high every rugby player chases, that kind of emotional intensity when you win something. And obviously then we had, you know, the trophy presentation. And but like afterwards, I actually felt sick for about half an hour. I think it was just the culmination of a lot of everything that had happened on the day. And like, but after then we got on the plane back home. We met Pat Kenny in the airport actually and covered him in beer. I remember that one.
I'd say he's forgiven you, Mike. He's working here. He'll be okay.
Yeah, there's a couple of pictures still floating around of him getting doused. And then we went back to the Burlington Hotel and stayed there to the small hours. And I probably got home in a taxi around 5 in the morning, I'd say.
Mike Ross and Alan Quinlan joining us here on Off the Ball Saturday on the Saturday panel, talking about European Cup Finals 2000, 2002 Munster lost, 2006, 2008 Munster won, and then Leinster winning in 2009. 11 and 12 was when Mike played, and 2018, of course, in Bilbao. 53106, folks, memories of you when you travelled with Munster or Leinster to European Cup Finals. What was it like? Share your stories with us. We're going to be coming back after the news. Did you go to any of these finals, these European Cup Finals? And this is Off the Ball Saturday on News Talk. You can also tweet us Off the Ball. Back after the news shortly.
The Saturday panel on Off the Ball.
This is Off the Ball Saturday on News Talk with John Duggan. 3 to 5 o'clock, you can text us on 53106. You can tweet us at Off the Ball. You can also watch us. We're streaming live as well now on Off the Ball social channels. You can check us out on Periscope, on Twitter, at Off the Ball, on YouTube, on Facebook. You can also listen on the Go Loud app. This week's Saturday panel talking about European Rugby Cup Finals, Heineken Cup Finals, Munster and Leinster. Normally around this time of year, we'll be watching a European decider. But today, luckily, we've got two past champions and household names. Munster's Alan Quinlan and Leinster's Mike Ross on the show. Thanks so much for joining us again, lads. The hand of back. I believe, Alan, at the time in 2002 in Cardiff, you were the other side of the scrum. What was going through your head? Did you see it at the time? Was it later that you saw it? What was going through your mind?
No, it was later, John, that I saw it. I think we'd switched David Wallace to number 8 while he was so quick and powerful off the scrum. And the plan was to try and get up on the tight head side and see if we could launch Wally off the scrum and get close to the line and score. And I just think I heard the shout in the crowd and the reaction then from Stringer when I looked up, and Joel Jews, the ref, didn't see it or didn't do anything about it anyway at the time. But yeah, it was disappointing because it was a lifeline for us. It was a chance of maybe trying to get a score to win the game. But it wasn't meant to be, and he got away with it. If I did that, I'd definitely get caught. There's no doubt about it. And but people still remind him. I met him recently, and they still talk to him about a Munster fans. There's still a bit of bitterness there, but I don't. I think we're beaten by the better team anyway, and there was no guarantees we would have scored, but it was a bit of cynical play that I certainly probably can't criticise, because I was probably not the... I was pretty good at the cynical stuff myself at times and occasions, but it's still spoken about.
Mike, did you have any kind of sense of what was going on when you were in the crowd in Cardiff that day?
Oh, no, we saw it on the big screen. And I say, Quinny just wished he thought of it first. But, look, if like one of the Munster lads had done it, he'd still be getting pints bought from as we speak. But, unfortunately, you know, it was like, as Quinny said, there was no guarantee that you were going to score off that scrum, but it was a chance, and you never know what could happen. So that was what was taken away from it. It's that chance of scoring. I remember being fairly gutted after, you know, having made it to the game, and then seeing that, it just left a sour taste in my mouth as a fan afterwards.
Denny Ryan's been untouched on Twitter. Four of us rented a house near Newport for four nights for the 06 final. That was near Cardiff. What a weekend. Never saw so many for one team at a neutral final. Trevor Halstead, what a player. Leamy after the game with a tip flag. Cardiff Streets, post-game madness. Two of us Leeds fans went to the playoff final against Watford the next day. Lost 3-0. I think that was what it's all about, guys, over the last two decades. It's your friends and your family and the people that the stories. And this guy was telling me, I think on Twitter earlier on, it was just this mad story that he had that for me. I'm just trying to bring it up here. 2006, five of us flew to London, rented a car to drive to Cardiff. No accommodations, had to sleep in the boot. But after reaching the promised land earlier that day, the boot might as well have been the Ritz.
It's there's so many of those stories, John. My mates all trying to make it as cheap as possible on the trip, because obviously the charter flights were a bit dear, the regular flights, so people would fly all over England and hire cars, trains, buses, and go on the ferry and stuff like that. And I think the one thing that was very, very stressful, I'm not sure what it was like for Mike, was particularly if you get to the bigger stages, the semi-finals and the finals, was ticket requests. So many requests, even the night before, morning of the game, getting people texting you saying, look, any chance, so sorry for disturbing you, we're short one, or somebody's let us down for tickets, or we went to collect them in the hotel and they're gone and they disappeared. And God be good to Pat Gertie, our PRO at the time.
Yeah, God rest him, yeah.
Pat was brilliant, because you could just kind of dial out the mobile and say, Pat, will you just handle this situation here? My mum was on to me, or a cousin was on to me for somebody else. And he would just end up going up to reception in the hotel, sitting there in the morning of the game and making phone calls and texting people and arranging where to leave tickets and stuff like that. But that was probably the most stressful part. I remember when I got to 08, I said to my mum, I'm getting the tickets done at the start of the week. Here they are. I'd maybe 20, 25 tickets, distribute them and no more. And lo and behold, Friday evening, the phone was fine, and my mother was one of them. Sorry for disturbing you. So it wasn't just friends, it was family members as well who just couldn't resist. But it was a good complaint in a sense that, and I often hear sports people talking about that, how do you look after the tickets, All-Ireland finals and the GAA players distributing tickets and stuff. But that was the most stressful part of it. Wasn't the match at all, it was trying to find tickets for people.
Mike, did you have a firm Moy entourage following you with Leinster in those years, 11 and 12?
Yeah, I would have had done, yeah. And like I can sympathise with Quinny on the ticket requests, because, look, as people will ask you for tickets. I mean, often, you know, there's no malice in it. They might know you, and they think maybe there's an infinite ticket printer somewhere that you have access to, but that's not the case, you know. Even when I was in Ireland, I mean, we got our allocation, and that was it. And if you wanted more, that they're hard to get even for us. So, you know, it's not like we had a magic hotline that would supply tickets on demand. But, like, we did our best, and usually people ended up getting there some way, you know, whether they met someone at a tout outside, or someone they met, a friend of theirs, the tickets, or there's usually, you know, fans find a way, especially into big days.
53106 for your text messages. Remember travelling to Geneva for a pool game when Munster played Borgoyne. ERC were trying to expand the game in Europe at the time. That is from John and Roscommon. Ask Quinny what he said to Fabian Palou, that he gave him the kick. That's one of my favourite memories of the 2008 final. That is from Kieran in Tipperary.
Oh, Jesus, I've spoken about this loads of times. I think everyone loves this, like, and they remember me for this. Before the game, Byron Keller was scrum half for Toulouse, very abrasive, very influential player, and very strong and powerful scrum half for Toulouse. He was former All Black at that stage. And he was quite vocal. And my job was kind of, which was a very dangerous thing, to give me a license to kind of get involved with somebody. So I remember Declan Kidney saying, look, put pressure on Keller. He's such a good player for them. He makes them tick. And I think it was a scrum at one stage, and Keller started shouting something at Nigel Owens, trying to get a penalty against us. And I kind of started shouting something back at him. And then I kind of stepped out from the side of the scrum, and Fabian Palouse ended up standing in front of me. So I accidentally stepped on his toe, and he kicked me up the backside, and we got a penalty. So that's it. I didn't say anything to him, but I couldn't believe that he had done something like that. Someone who was so disciplined all the time, captained his country so many times, and captained Toulouse. And John Hayes always said that to me, that I even broke Fabian Palouse. I broke all my own teammates' heart and head over the years, and finally I broke Fabian Palouse, someone who was so disciplined on the field. But I was surprised with it, probably a little bit embarrassed when I look back at the reaction, but I'd probably given away so many penalties over the years, here was one that I was going to get for myself.
Mike, was Quinny Gabby?
One of my first biggest memories of Quinny was we're an Irish training camp. And we're kind of doing the lean-in scrums, and myself and Quinny were the kind of, we'll call it the second team. And I was leaning against Marcus, and Quinny chucked his shoulder into me as I went and lean in, and I went in fairly hot. And then Marcus got fairly fired up with me over the fact that it was supposed to be lean-in scrums, and I was coming in hot. And he said, if you want a scrummage, we'll scrummage. And then looking back at Quinny, he's telling him, take no shit from that fella. And Yeah, but like you always want a character like Quinny on your own team, you know, especially when if he's getting guys to make uncharacteristic errors, because rugby can be often as much a mental game as a physical game.
You'd want me on your team if I was playing well and I was disciplined, but and then if you're playing the opposition, you give me a license to annoy someone, John. I was your man to do that. It's no great trait or boast, but I suppose I was annoying, to say the least.
I'll just throw out the satisfaction, guys, to the pair of you, of winning the second final. So 08 for you, Quinny, your man of the match. That must be an amazing feeling to be crowned man of the match. And then the following year at Twickenham, Mike, you hammered Ulster by 28 points. You got a couple of early tries, 42-14.
Yeah, I mean, we were in, you know, probably prime form at that time, you know. We had a tough route to the final. We beat Claremont by the skin of our teeth, you know. So by the time we got to Twickenham, we knew that, like, confidence was sky high. And, you know, unfortunately for Ulster, that's the kind of form they met us in that day. I remember I was rooming with Brad Thorne, and, you know, if you want a man to give you confidence, Brad's the man to do it.
How did he do that?
Well, he's just such a powerful guy, and, like, he was my tight head lock, you know, so I knew I had him behind me in the scrum, so wasn't worrying about the scrum too much that way. And, you know, he's just a rocking machine, tackling animal, and he'd been there, he'd done that, he'd done everything in NRL, he'd done everything in rugby union, so, you know, it's just, and that was the kind of thing about the Leinster team at that time. We had a lot of leaders in there, you know, so the year before we had Nathan Hines, and, like, Shane Jennings, Brian O'Driscoll, Jamie Heaslip, Leo Cullen, lots of guys with, you know, high leadership skills. So if you have a team full of leaders like that, you know, it's a good place to be in.
And Quinny, were you feeling in 08 that was just the peak of the mountain when you're man of the match in a final?
Yeah, people often ask that question, John, which was better, 06 or 08. I think there's a difference, obviously, because I played all the games in 08 and 06. I had that injury in round one in Sale, thought my career was over. Like I said a few minutes ago, I came on for 4 minutes in 06 in the final, and I was the happiest substitute in probably the history of anyone who's ever come off the bench. that was incredibly special because of the sacrifice and the training and the comeback and the joy I felt in 06. It didn't matter to me that I didn't play the first 76 minutes of the game and I was a sub. It really was a culmination of probably 7 or 8 years trying to get to this point and get the trophy. So they're very hard to separate. People would think, oh yeah, 08, I got man of the match, played the full game. But 06 was just incredibly special for me. And I remember going to the dressing room afterwards, getting a little quiet area on my own and just literally going, that's just phenomenal. The joy I'm feeling internally here, as opposed to 6 months previous where I sat in the dressing room in Stockport while the second half of the Munster Sale game was going on, and I sat there on my own crying, thinking my career is over. This is it. I was about to sign a new contract and my career is over now. I'm not going to get back from this. The RFU are not going to give me a contract. What am I going to do? And, you know, 6 months later, I'm sitting there on my own in a quiet little spot saying, this means everything to me. You know, it means the world for all the effort, all the training, wearing my heart on my sleeve, having great good days, bad days, days I messed up, days I played really well. And that was just that moment. It was just very special. 08 then, of course, you know, I felt I came back from the World Cup in 07 and I didn't play for 6 weeks in France. And I remember, you know, coming towards the end of my career, I trained my socks off and did loads of fitness in France. And I came back and I had a brilliant European campaign, given I was 34 at that stage, but I played really well. And to finish it off at the end of the season and be man of the match in the final, I'm not sure I deserved it. Loads of the other players probably played better on the day, but I got this man of the match thing. And I remember running off my own after the initial celebrations when the whistle went against Toulouse, and I kind of ran down the field on my own. I just wanted to kind of look around and see the crowd and experience that after the initial kind of jumping for joy. I just wanted to see and soak this whole thing in the second time. And they were both incredibly special, John, I think, and I find it very hard to separate which one was best.
Mike, did you feel that all that those years in Harlequins going to play in England really helped you reach the summit with Leinster and then play for Ireland? Like the, you had to go and you had to go and find your own way in the game, and then you ended up playing for Leinster and you ended up in that comeback team in 2011. Did you feel that same sense of fulfilment as Quinny's been talking about there?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, with regards to Harlequins, I mean, I wouldn't have had a professional career if it wasn't for them. They gave me 3 years of a good grounding, especially in the Premiership, where you have to, it's just a fairly forward-oriented league, so you kind of earn your wings there, or earn your spurs there fairly quickly. If not, you're gone. And I played about 80 games in 3 years for them, and that was really stood to me when I went over to Leinster. But I've been watching, you know, people win high in cups 3 years, and when it was my turn, I couldn't believe that, like, I was having this chance and this was happening to me in a way, you know. It was just kind of like, I can't believe I've actually won a Heineken Cup here, you know. And then to go and win a second one the following year was, you know, stuff I wouldn't have even considered when I was growing up playing rugby. So for the club game, it's probably one of the pinnacle of the club game.
And for the Perry lads, Declan Kidney and Joe Schmidt, huge influences.
Yeah, for sure. I think Declan was incredibly important for us, John. He started out in 97 and got the job by default and came into a room and told us someday we'll win a European Cup and we'll be the best team in Europe. And we thought he was crazy because we didn't believe it ourselves. We could never, as Mike said, there's surreal moments when you get to this point, because like, this is the Champions League of rugby and you're the best team in Europe. We're Irish guys here and we're top of the pile. And I suppose we experienced a good few times getting nearly one hand on the trophy. When we finally won it, we were, as I said earlier, we were in better position. But Declan would have been central to a huge part of that, particularly the mental side of it and making us believe in ourselves more. And he evolved as well from probably having, coming straight out of school, being a school teacher in 97, taking over a professional team, of adults, and you know, he was coaching Irish schools and stuff like that, but he would have got to know the players and learned how to deal with the group in a better way and taken feedback and brought good coaches in around him. Niall O'Donovan was our forwards coach. He was brilliant. Jerry Holland, our manager. They were all kind of special, but Declan was probably the one that had brought that success and was involved in all those disappointments with us as well, and was very open to player feedback and how would we get better. I remember, John, every year after we had a disappointing loss, or particularly in the earlier days, everybody would sit down, how are we going to get better? And it was probably one of the main reasons why very few Munster players left that group, left to go to France or England, or one or two had to go and they wanted to go and experience different opportunities, and they mightn't have got contracts. But every year we got better, we felt the fitness regime, the facilities, the knowledge we were getting from coaches and stuff was getting better all the time. And it was player driven as well. But Declan wouldn't have won that one in 06 unless Declan, you know, guided us and steered us and made us believe in ourselves more in 97. And it was certainly the start of an incredible journey.
And Mike, with Joe, what was your experience?
He was probably the best coach I ever had, you know, hands down. I think of all the medals I finished my career with, he was responsible for all but one of them. What he brought to the team at the time, and you know, not just from him, but there, like with John O'Gibbs as well as forwards coach, and Greg Feek, then as scrum coach, and they've all, like, Greg Feek's now the New Zealand scrum coach. John O'Gibbs has been, I forget where he is now, the La Rochelle, but three a very talented coaching team, and I suppose what Joe brought to us was a relentless focus on getting better, and he never accepted mediocrity in training sessions. He was always pushing us to get better, and like some of the first phase plays he brought in were absolutely got us over the line a couple of times. I mean, that try that Keane Healy scored against Claremont in the semi-final of 2012 was straight out of his book playbook, and he's a very good man for analysing a team, finding their weaknesses, and then ruthlessly exploiting it.
I'm just thinking about scrums you mentioned there, Mike, and Quinny as well. Social distancing and sport and contact sport. How is it possible to avoid the threat of being infected in this difficult situation we're involved in now? Would you be comfortable guys playing in this environment, Mike and Quinny?
I would say it's not. It's not possible. Rugby is a contact sport, so you're going to have contact. Especially in scrums, where you know there were scrum boxes around before COVID-19, so, and that was that still gets passed around. Look, the only thing you can do really is probably testing, and lots of it. I don't know how that would be perceived politically if you're testing, you know, privileged rugby players, but I think that's the only way around it.
So you wouldn't be comfortable, Mike, would you not be comfortable then playing before, let's say, if you were still playing before there's a vaccine?
Rugby players are probably in the demographic that'd be a fairly low risk of anything bad happening to them if they did catch it. But ultimately, if you want to play a game, I think, and not leave yourself open to possibly prosecution at some later point, you're going to have testing.
I'm not sure, John, who was Mike referencing there when he said privileged rugby players, because I'm a bogger from Tipperary and you're a bogger from Mike. So I don't know where you got that privileged rugby players about. But for me, John, I play. I think the only way it's going to work, it's impossible to adhere to social distancing. So there's going to be close contact. And if rugby goes back, I think there's just going to have to be a testing scenario where they test players before. And that template is happening this weekend in the Bundesliga, how they're going to work it and test the players and how they have tested the players and trained. And if that's successful, maybe it will be a template for rugby to test and maybe isolate players for a couple of days and put them into a group and keep them together and test them all and maybe release them, test them after the games then again. But who knows, will we get to that stage where we get to? But I'd be optimistic that rugby will be back before we have a vaccine or before this thing is all over, and it'll probably be behind closed doors rugby, if at all possible. And I'm hearing that that's the plan and that's what people want to try and do. I think it's you may have some resistance from players who, like you asking the question, would I play? I would. But I'd like to know that there's testing in place, and that if there is a testing scenario in place, and a plan and a bit of structure around that, that nobody wants to cause issues here or damage anybody else's health if they were a carrier.
Yes.
That's the big problem. If you played and you were asymptomatic and you had no symptoms and you infected other people and you went home and infected other people who can do that to in the community, that's the big issue here. But I will be really interesting, and I know you're probably across the Bundesliga stuff, John, way more than me, but it'll be interesting to see how that goes today.
Yeah, well, our rugby coverage, we're speaking about European Cup finals, brought to you by Vodafone, a team of us, everyone in. Just on this proposal, guys, for next year, there's 24 teams, probably three teams of, or three groups of eight. I don't mean in the pools, I mean as in three batches of eight, the English, the French and the Pro 14. What do you think of this new format that's being proposed for the European Cup next season?
Well, that's the way it used to be, wasn't it? You know, there was 24 teams when Quinny and I were playing Heineken Cups. So I'm not sure of the logic behind it, but I wouldn't. The more people play in European Cup, the better, I think.
I think it's down to basically, John, Mike, that it's down to the fact that the leagues aren't finished. The Gallagher Premiership, the Top 14, the Pro 14. And, you know, you go with your normal six. An example in France is Toulouse, who won the competition four times, are sitting seventh, and Montpellier, another powerhouse in French rugby, are sitting eighth. So they miss out in Europe if you go with your normal six. So I think the idea is to try and give a little bit of wriggle room there to allow one or two more, a couple of more teams into it. It'd be good news for Connacht because there'd be four Irish teams in there. Now there's no reason why to say that they wouldn't qualify through the Pro 14, but it would mean four would go in, and that'd be brilliant. But go back to the old format. I think it's only a proposal, and it would be run off over 8 weeks. So I think it's just really to facilitate teams who would have been outside of that top six to make it a little bit more fair.
Sure. A group of six of us were at the 06 final, stayed in a small place called Pencode in the Sticks. From Cardiff, had a great night there, and the day Cardiff was unreal. See thousands on the street, no trouble, but the madness contrasted to the day after when Leeds United were in town. Great days out. That is Micah Chip, GA fan. Lads, we're about to leave you go. Thanks so much for sharing your memories today about the European Cup finals. Obviously, we'd be loved to be at one in Marseille at this time of the year. Just before we go, I know you're big into tech, Mike. How do you think the world is going to change with this pandemic, with the future and the current and everything with tech?
Well, I certainly think if I was owning commercial property, I'd be sweating right now, because I think remote working is going to be here to stay. A lot of companies were on the fence about it, and they've been forced into it, and the world hasn't ended. So I can see less of a need for offices. And remote working, I think if you can do it, because you know, cuts down traffic, cuts down stress. And importantly, it cuts down how much office space you need for companies.
Alan, Mike, thanks so much for joining us today on the panel.
Cheers. Thanks, John.
Alan Quinlan and Mike Ross there sharing their memories of European Cup's past. Difficult time at the moment. Obviously, we'd love to be playing and supporting teams in Leinster and Munster and the other teams, but that's the way it is at the moment. World Cup 1974 between 3 and 5, and also football chat about the League of Ireland's resumption with Danny McDonnell and Johnny Ward. 53106 for your text messages. This is Off the Ball Saturday on News Talk. Back after this.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
That was an OTB Podcast Network presentation.